Hello, everyone. It's your host, Luke West, back with another episode of Imperfect, where we discuss topics of masculinity and manhood more intentionally and purposefully. On this episode, we have Andrew Metz. In a little over a decade, Andrew has risen from an entry-level lead generation position to vice president overseeing all new business generation and a team of 30 at a SaaS-based insurtech company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Andrew's tremendous hard work, desire for continuous learning and improvement, generosity and humility have earned him recognition as a catalyst for growth within his organization. Metz invests in the people around him and inspires and encourages them to attain their personal best. His willingness to share the early lessons of his business career and personal mistakes make him a remarkable public speaker. His abilities have resulted in regular speaking requests from UWM's Lubar School of Business, Marquette University School of Communication, and local high schools. His generosity and accomplishments post-graduation from UW-Milwaukee have earned him Graduate of the Last Decade Award from his alma mater. Metz is active on LinkedIn, always sharing his business lessons through humor and entertaining storytelling. And on this episode, we go deep into his journey as a father and an alcohol consumption, not addiction, but just drinking alcohol every day and how he overcame that. And so without further ado, here is my episode with Andrew. All right, I am with my guest, Andrew Metz, here recording at night, but we're just going to jump right into it. So, Andrew, if you were to have anyone over for dinner, dead or alive, who would it be and what would you cook for them?
There's certainly a lot of people to pick from, famous people I'm intrigued with. I love music, and there's certainly a lot of people that come to mind, but the one person that I would be absolutely interested in having a longer conversation in my adult self is my mother's father, my grandfather. He raised seven children, and all his children have been wildly successful in different fields. And there's people that have received PhDs. There's a three-star general in there. There's professors, but none of them ended up in business. And he was a sales guy. And we had great conversations even at 12, 13 years old. He passed away when I was 14. You know, now as a man at 35 years old, raising my own family, having a career in sales, you know, the alcohol topic that we'll talk about today, he had his own struggles with alcohol and actually was dry the whole time I knew him. But he's probably one of the only figures in my life that's kind of gone through that transformation. But I always ask his siblings, my aunts and uncles, I always say, tell me a story about your father, because I just want to collect as many as I can. And I remember having really in-depth conversations with him even when I was a teenager. He was just one of those kind of guys that was, he was just a hell of a guy. So that's an easy one for me. What would I cook him? He was Irish, but his wife, my grandmother, was Italian. And the joke was always at the holidays, like Thanksgiving, Christmas, we always just got carryout pizza. It was the joke. Everyone got, you know, made the fancy ham or turkey or whatever. We got pizza. So I think that would be the easy. I don't know if I would cook it, but I'd probably carry out pizza and just cut to the chase so we could talk more.
Yeah. And what would you talk about and why?
Yeah, I mean, I have so many questions now that I'm a father of three. I have an 8-year-old, a 5-year-old, and today my daughter's 18 months today. So we did a 1.5-year cake for her at dinner.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it was fun. And you know, I'm 35 years old. I think a lot different than when I was 25. And the last time I talked to him, I was probably 14. So I think a lot different than when I was 14 years old. So, you know, raising a family of seven, I'd be so curious. There was probably always, you know, something going awry, something to work on. And even with my kids, you know, nothing's ever perfect. You know, we're dealing with some things with different kids for different things. Some of it's, you know, one of it, I think when I talked to you last, I had a son that got a tooth knocked out, and, you know, I have a son that's, he's about to turn 6. He's very small. I'm not a big guy myself, but people think he's 4 years old, and, you know, he's kind of dealing with those emotions, and he's the smallest kid in his class. And, you know, it's like, nothing's ever perfect. And that's life. You know, you're trying to make the best of the situation you have. But I would be so curious to ask him, with seven children, there was probably even more problems. And he had a very relaxed approach, and he wasn't like I gotta fix everything, and he wasn't a perfectionist. And I know some of his siblings have told me stories like they would come to him with a problem and he would always respond with another question, and he would allow them to kind of figure it out on their own as opposed to providing some advice or just giving them the answer. And I always admired that. And I mean, that's just like through secondhand kind of story. So I would probably ask him how he, you know, how he problem solved as a parent. I'd probably ask some questions about business, and I'd probably ask some questions about just being a man, and, you know, how he progressed through his years of, I know he definitely changed a lot, and I feel myself going through those same transformations in my mid 30s here.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you said that, you know, his style was much more laid back. Do you think that's something that happens as you have more kids? Because my mom, like I'm the youngest of four.
Okay.
And my mom is just like, you know, when it comes to your third and fourth kid, if they get hurt, they get hurt. You just could become a lot more lackadaisical about it because you're not as high strung that the first kid is, you know, the first kid's been through it all. The second one is like a bit more chill.
Yes.
By me, they were like much more relaxed.
Yeah. No, that's a great question, Luke. My mom was the oldest of the seven. And I think in a lot of ways, she became, you know, a mother figure to the younger kids. In fact, her youngest sibling, when she was born, my mother was in college. So you think about that gap. And I think they really did take care of themselves. And I know one of the things he always imparted on them was, it's your own life. And it wasn't done in a, like, go figure it out, kid. It was done in a, you're going to choose where you're going to go, and we're not going to tell you what to do. And they all did. That's what I admire about all my mom's siblings. They all have kind of taken a different path. They're all in different fields, but they're all highly successful, however you define success. And that's not just an income thing. It's a, you know, making an impact on people's life kind of thing. And I'm very curious to learn more about his parenting style as a parent of three. You know, it kind of feels like the biggest responsibility I have in my world right now is trying to be an awesome parent and, you know, raising great, you know, respectful, nice, well-rounded kids.
And, you know, it's an interesting time that you bring it up, because currently, as we record this, hopefully we're not in this time when this posts, but we're currently in quarantine.
Yep.
And obviously there's a lot of differences that come from those instances. You know, I was raised being homeschooled for the first until I was 14.
Wow.
So my mom was kind of used to having all the kids at home.
Yep.
But in terms of yourself, you're home, you have to work, you have to do all that, and you have to take care of them.
Yep.
What's that process been like for you? Are you using it as a teaching moment? I've seen some beautiful things on LinkedIn. Kind of how's your parenting style adjusting to this moment right now?
Well, first of all, my wife's going to get all the credit. She's doing all the heavy lifting on the academic side. So we're finishing our second week at home here. I got a second grader, a kindergartner, and then the baby. But yeah, it's been, you know, it's been really awesome. I'm always glasses half full guy. Like, this is the weirdest times ever, right? I just got off the phone with my 70-year-old father earlier today. And he's like, Andrew, I've never seen this in my life. And you think about that, in 70 years, he's never seen this before. You know, it's so interesting because I've worked at an office that's about 30 minutes from my house for 11 and a half years. And I've gone into the office every day, more or less, unless I travel for work or I take a family vacation. But I've never worked from my home for more than 1 or 2 days at a time. And I'm finishing, tomorrow will be my second full week from home. And I think if I reflect back on it, I've seen my kids more in the last 2 weeks from a work week perspective than I've ever seen in their lives. You know, I've been able to eat lunch with my kids, and, you know, right around 4:30 or 5 when I would start my commute home, we've walked to the park, you know. So it's really been we've gotten more FaceTime, and yeah, everyone's kind of at everyone, you know, not everything's perfect. We're all like, you know, in quarantine here, a family of five, and, you know, there's emotions and things going on, but overall I'm kind of looking at this experience going, you know, 10 years from now, I think we'll look back on this fondly as like, hey, we were a family then. We made some memories. We spent more time together. And, you know, that's what raising a family is all about, is just those experiences. It's not one defining moment. It's kind of that chapter in life to go, yeah, that we raised our children together. And that's how my wife and I are looking at this experience.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful that you're raising them together. I think that last phrase, like, obviously, you know, when you see parents, it's a dual goal and a dual job. But a lot of times you'll see that, you know, men get put aside as not the primary caretaker. And that's a lot of us, it being our fault in the sense that we were going to work, but also social expectations that we were the breadwinners. That's kind of shifted now. Kind of what's your perspective on that? Like, obviously you being home and being this is a great chance for that primary caretaker role to kind of evolve, and we're seeing it grow in the generation. But kind of what's your experience with that on like a more personal level?
Yeah, I mean, my wife and I have a traditional setup. She is at home with the kids full time and I go to work. But at the end of the day, I just try to be as involved as I can. I have an awesome employer that gives me a ton of flexibility. I've worked with them for over a decade. And I'll take 2 hours here and there to go to class things. And like, you know, my son had a birthday party in January at his school and it was a 2-hour thing, or, you know, it was maybe an hour. But I left a little early. And to me, those are the moments I don't want to miss. So I'm not doing the heavy lifting. Like, my wife's like taking them to and from school and she's on track of like, when's the field trip and when does this need to be done? And when do you need to bring something? Cause I'm not organized. I'm a little like fly by the seat of my pants kind of guy. But that being said, I do know when those important moments are there to be present and to pay attention and to hopefully not be answering work emails or getting texts from my team or whatever, because that's always there. But there's moments where you go, you know, for 60 minutes, I'm just going to turn my phone off, or I'm going to leave it in the car and I'm going to be in the moment with my 8-year-old because they're having a school celebration, you know, for his birthday. And those kind of moments, I try to lock those in my mind, because I think as I look back, you know, not to get too down there, but like, you know, the cliche is always like, no one said on their deathbed they wish they worked more, right? But you do think about kind of those special moments. So yeah, I try to be as involved as I can, but you know, I have a demanding work schedule, but I've never prioritized work over family stuff, because it's pretty obvious for me kind of what the choice is from a prioritization standpoint.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And now to kind of get into how we reached out in the first place was through LinkedIn. I saw a comment that you made. It will all tie back to the family aspect, of course. But I saw a comment on LinkedIn about how you kind of quit alcohol and you've been sober for a while now. And we had a discussion about the vulnerability that you pose on LinkedIn and how powerful that is. So before we get deeper into kind of the alcohol part, kind of why don't you talk about your journey of being vulnerable on a very open platform like LinkedIn, and how that's kind of built your confidence to be where you are now, or in being willing to share a lot of that story?
You know, I manage a sales team of about 30 people. And I think there's a, you know, everyone's got an ego and there's a, like a social stigma about putting yourself out there. But I also kind of have this like corporate status. I don't want to say that in an arrogant way, but like, you know, you got a lot of people kind of looking up to you through the food chain. And so that was something I considered too. But ultimately, you know, they're getting what they're getting, which is Andrew Metz. And that's the good, bad, the ugly. And everyone has these struggles. Just some people don't talk about it. And I really, you know, my wife encouraged me. She's just such a great support for me. And she's encouraged me to share about this as I started putting out LinkedIn content. She said, because I kind of went through this evolution with myself where, you know, drinking just kind of became this daily thing. It wasn't even enjoyable as much as just, it was just something I did every day. And I started to hate the fact that I wasn't getting satisfaction out of something that I knew was kind of not great for my body, but also very aware of like how I'm a role model to my kids. My boys are of the age at 8 and 5 years old where they're paying attention to everything. And I realize, you know, if every time I get home, I'm drinking, I'm setting some expectation for them, right? So once I kind of went through that process and I quit drinking, I kind of had to get my feet under me I didn't want to like the next day be like, I quit drinking alcohol, because it was one day. But I think I waited till I got to 100 days and it was just past January. And I don't know if Canada is big, but in the US it's dry January where everyone takes off for 30 days and cleanses their liver and feels good about themselves. And I think my post was something like, dry January is over, but my dry journey continues. And I went out there and I just said, like 100 days ago, I decided to stop drinking. And here's why, and here's what I've learned. And the response was tremendous, not only with people I didn't know, but with a lot of people I did know. And, you know, I think what I feel proud of about it, not only I feel proud of myself and kind of how my children view me, because they've made a lot of comments. They're old enough to be aware, and they see I'm drinking ginger ale now, not beer. You know, I've had a lot of people inquire a lot about it, like young professionals. You know, I work with a lot of people in their mid to late 20s or early 30s, and, you know, they might look up to me as a mentor type figure, and they've asked me about it, which I think is great. I haven't been evangelistic about it, but, and I'm not necessarily anti-alcohol, for the record. I think there's, you know, responsible ways to enjoy things. And to me, it was just, that was that one thing that I didn't like about myself. You know, having the balls to go out there and put myself out there. I wrote a post later where I said, like, literally my finger was hovering over, you know, I was on my keyboard. I was hovering, it hovered over the mouse for like 20 seconds. Like, am I really going to do this? Like, it was all ready and set to go. And I shot a video, my wife shot it, and I had this big, you know, long copy written, and I just hit it. And as soon as I hit it, I like just felt instantly relieved. Like, that was the right move. I had like no regret. I felt free about it. And that's actually how I felt when I decided to stop drinking. That was the moment I had stopped. There was a defining moment. My wife actually captured it. She took pictures of it, and I'll share those at some point when I'm ready. But, you know, I read into a lot of how your gut feel is. And my gut feel was like, that was great. Like, I had no buyer's remorse on that decision. I knew it was the right thing to do. And it's been good since. I mean, here we are, we're talking because of it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you said when you posted it, it got a lot of, you know, attraction and support. And you weren't like an alcoholic or anything like that.
No.
But I'm very curious then why so many people were so supportive of just quitting alcohol in the first place. Like, to me, it says a lot about culture. Everyone knows that we kind of overconsume or may overconsume alcohol. But the idea that it kind of gets a lot of support is very fascinating to me. So why do you think that might be?
That's a great question. Once I figured that out, I think I could be even more, you know, influential, hopefully. I think if I put myself in their shoes maybe 2 years ago, it's one of those things where, yeah, I say I'm going to drink one or two, but it ends up being four or five. And, you know, alcohol kind of has a way to be a slippery substance in that sense, because, you know, after you have one or two drinks, you're judgment is impaired, and you go, well, what the hell is the difference if I have two or four, right? And that was me. I probably told people for years, yeah, I have one or two beers at night, but it probably was three or four very often. Though it's socially acceptable, there's still, you know, I think a lot of people have come out and said, wow, that's really cool, I've thought about quitting. Or they've said, I'm cutting back. Or they said, I've more or less quit, but I still drink at, you know, birthday parties and, you know, football games or whatever. Like, and that's fine. Like, I don't have any judgment. I'm only going to control me. And if that leads by example, great. If it doesn't, whatever. I got to think, you know, take care of my own body, my own being a role model here. So I think it's one of those things where people kind of know, you know, it's like working out. It's like people go, oh, I should work out, but I don't. And people probably go, I probably drink more than I should. And I think someone coming out and just, you know, ripping the bandaid off and being honest. And, you know, I think a lot of people that I know that like me as a person probably appreciate that I'm making a healthy decision for myself, and they're supporting that.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And it's kind of like when I was in university, which was just over a year ago, sometimes I'd go to a party and I wouldn't drink. And if you tell people you're not drinking, they'd be like, oh, that's really cool. And it's like this weird thing. Like, people have two opinions about it, that you're a pussy, or that, you know, that's really cool. And like, that's really brave of you for doing that. I'm like, I just didn't really feel like drinking tonight. It has nothing to, I would rather just not drink than be pressured into drinking than be pressured into drinking. I'm like, it's a very simple decision to me. If I don't feel like doing it, I'm not going to do it. I've always had this opinion about university and alcohol is like, I would see a lot of my friends go out 3, 4, 5 times a week. And my one issue was that people were gathering together because of the alcohol, not because they wanted to gather together. It's a kegger first and then people come together. But if, you know, if it's me and my friends at dinner and we're talking, get a drink, because you're not there to drink, you're there for dinner. And I always thought that was very interesting, just the way that students approached, like, they weren't really getting together because they were friends or they wanted to talk. They just were like, let's drink and then we'll party and then we have a lot of fun. And, like, you know, part of me misses out that I felt like I missed out on that culture or didn't participate in it. But then I think, you know, I have very strong friendships from my time in university that I wouldn't change and rather have shallow friendships. Not to say that, you know, people that participated had shallow relationships, but that was kind of, they were built around stories rather than like personal emotional feelings, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, here in Milwaukee, you know, all these, you know, a lot of beer culture, a lot of German descent, and, you know, beer's kind of, you know, it's the Milwaukee Brewers and it's Miller Brewing, and it's just part of the culture. And I find when people, you know, from the West Coast come out here, they go, God, you guys drink at, you know, kids' baptisms, kids' birthday parties, like literally any excuse to get together. And that just becomes part of the fabric. But I think as you kind of take a step back and you start, you know, it's like, I remember like doing a physical once and the doctor's like, well, how many drinks do you have a week? And you're like, oh shit. When you really start adding it up, you look at it, it's like 35, but of course you say like 15 and they go, that's a lot. You know, it's yeah. like, well, then you think in your head, 35 is a lot too. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and I think that goes back to why people kind of applaud it is they know somewhere, you know, and once again, this isn't like an ethical or moral thing, but I think everyone kind of, it's pretty well documented that alcohol is not good for your body and, you know, everything in moderation and that sort of thing. But I think most people probably overconsume and that's probably got something to do with it. So I think people applaud like the health changes, but I think people kind of applaud the authenticity and, you know, just being brave enough to put myself out there, because really putting yourself out there is just accepting the consequences that come with it. Right. And that's what I think people are afraid of. Like they wouldn't do it. Or some people would go, yeah, I would like to do that, but I'm not going to because so-and-so is going to, you know, frown upon it. But shit, man, I, you know, it's my life. So I ripped the Band-Aid off. And like I said, actually, the more public I get about it, the less social anxiety I have about it. Like I did a virtual happy hour today. One of my sales reps graduated our boot camp, which is a 7-week program.
Yeah.
And so usually you get a drink with a person. Well, everyone's remote, right? Because we're under quarantine. And we did a virtual happy hour. And it was really interesting. I don't know this guy that well. He's only been with our organization for 7 weeks. I hired him a couple months ago. And, you know, he's drinking a beer and everyone's drinking a beer. It's like a video conference like this. And he goes, Andrew, I know you don't drink, because he's seen my LinkedIn posts. And he goes, what are you drinking now? And I was like, oh, I'm drinking like a seltzer or whatever. So I just thought it was cool. Like I almost didn't even need to explain to him. He already knew based upon me talking about it publicly. So that's been kind of freeing in a lot of ways.
And you talked a little bit about Milwaukee culture and how that kind of built in you this the sense of drinking. Like obviously there's a big beer market there with the brewers and all the breweries. Like I know that I believe there's a Molson Coors there. How did that kind of play into the culture? How did that affect your mind when you made the decision? Did that make it any harder or more awkward when kind of explaining it like right away?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm in sales, and you know, it's part of the fabric is you're going to entertain people. You're going to wine and dine them. You're going to take them out to dinner. My internal employees, my company, which is an awesome company, and you know, they've fully supported me for the record, but you know, we have a bar in our office and we serve drinks all the time. And honestly, I still, even as a non-drinker, I still think it's cool because they've created kind of an atmosphere and it looks really cool. And you know, there's games and pool tables and all kinds of stuff. Like it's a cool tech firm, so it's all good, but like, it's almost taboo to not drink. And I don't know many people that don't drink. I've found out about a lot of people after I stopped, because then people came out and go, oh, I didn't drink. I was like, oh, I never knew that, you know, which is cool. But like, kind of go back to the theme of your podcast, my grandfather, my mother's father is probably the one guy from like a role model standpoint that didn't drink when I knew him, because he had a drinking problem and he stopped at one point. But, you know, I can't think of a lot of people in my life that like just stop cold turkey or don't drink. So yeah, I mean, you worry about what the perception is. You worry about socially, what does this mean? You know, I literally had a conversation with my wife, like, hey, I'm going to do this because it's the right thing to do, but I'm not sure if this is going to affect my work, you know, performance, because And those awkward moments might still happen where I go out to dinner with someone and they're ordering drinks and I'm like, hey, I don't drink. And I think that could be a buzzkill for them. And maybe that's the story I write in my head. But like, I was probably that guy, because I was always like, let's party, let's have a blast. And if someone wouldn't drink, then it's like, oh, okay. You know, so to me, it's just the conclusion I had to come to is I got to do what's best for me, regardless of how it makes other people feel. And if that makes them feel insecure, then maybe that says something more about them than me.
Yeah, 100%. I would 100% agree with that, because even though when there's times when I wouldn't drink at a party, you know, a lot of people would come up to me and just say that I'm a wimp, or, you know, like make fun of me for not drinking. And I just hold the mirror up to them and I'm like, listen, man, just because I'm not drinking doesn't make me any less of a man than you. And I'm sorry that you feel like you have to challenge my masculinity because I don't have alcohol in my hand. I'm sorry that the only way you can feel comfortable here is by getting extremely drunk, or, you know, like starting to get to that point where they're not making decisions for themselves. But kind of going back to, I think that's a growing culture here in Toronto as well. This idea of, you know, every day there's happy hours at almost any bar in Toronto. A lot of the tech companies have those beer on site and in the office, because that's something that they know the staff enjoy, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But I feel like that drinking culture is spreading to Toronto. We have quite a few breweries in like Waterloo in Toronto. We obviously have Steam Whistle. I think that's like the biggest one that we have, a couple others. But it is interesting how much alcohol becomes a fabric of an environment, both work and not work. And then obviously, if employees aren't careful, that can spread into awkward situations that they have to handle. And then that's an HR thing potentially. And so, like, it's not to say that that's the alcohol's fault. Like, everyone should be able to control their intake. But it is interesting how much we're seeing that grow as part of defining culture rather than the people. It's the alcohol within the people.
Yeah, that's well said. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole HR perspective that needs to be factored in. I think about myself as a leader at the organization, right? I've been there for 11 years. I manage this big team, but I've always been, even though, you know, you said earlier, like, you didn't consider yourself an alcoholic. Like, I don't know what an alcoholic, that definition's very gray, but I thought drinking every day, multiple drinks, you know, let's say 5 days a week, almost every day, that's a lot, right? There's some compound effect that had, but I was always very careful about, you know, consumption at work events and how do you carry yourself? Because, you know, one of the things I always think about, I think about this for parenting, is when you ignore things, if you're the leader, whether you're a parent or a sales manager or a mentor, when you ignore things, you're accepting it to those that are looking up to you. And so I think about that a lot as a parent, as a sales leader, as a mentor to young people. It's like, you got to go acknowledge and talk about these things. Otherwise they're going to go, hey, Andrew's doing this and he's my manager, right? So I guess this is okay, right? So that's part of the responsibility of leadership, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And kind of going back to how it kind of shifted your focus on your family. You know, you talked a lot about how that kind of gave you a lot more time with your kids, or your kids were starting to see that and notice it. Kind of how have you seen that change within them? Because obviously they're 8, 5 and a baby. And so them noticing that aspect of their father's life at such a young age is pretty impressionable, pretty impressive and obviously impressionable on them. So kind of what does that tell you about just like the intelligence of children and how they see their parents and the people around them?
Well, they observe everything. And like I said, I think if the norm is that I come home and drink every night, I would guess the odds of them doing the same is much higher. And me not necessarily wanting that for them was part of the consideration. You know, when I decided to stop, I actually read a book that I was thinking about it for a long time, and this book totally convinced me. And when I decided to stop, the last part of the book's called it's written by Alan Carr, and it's called The Easy Way to Control Your Drinking, I believe. And he's got this whole easy way method. He's actually more known for a stop smoking guy, but he's kind of parlayed that into other things. And the book was written in the 70s. It's very old. The last part of the book is you take your final drink, and he actually encouraged you to drink throughout the book. And it's an interesting book on psychology, because it's kind of reframed the whole way I look at alcohol. Like, I actually look at alcohol now like the way I look at tobacco. Like, if someone went in and went out and smoked a cigarette, it doesn't look alluring or appealing to me. And once again, I'm not judging people that smoke or drink, but I kind of look at it the same thing, because I kind of look at it for what it is. And the last part of the book is you're supposed to pour yourself a drink and kind of proclaim this is your final drink. And I was upstairs reading it. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I went downstairs and I told my wife to pour me a drink, and I held that drink and I told my 8-year-old and my 5-year-old. And I wanted this to kind of be like a dramatic moment, but I said, guys, you've seen me drink a lot, and this is the last drink I'm ever going to have, you're ever going to see me do. And I was holding my daughter at the time. I slugged it, and I honestly, I felt so free. I feel excited talking about it now. Like, it just felt like a really empowering moment where I'm in control of what's going on. And they still talk about it. And I was pretty emotional. You talk about masculinity and being a man, like, here I'm kind of crying in front of my kids, but it was a really big moment. My wife was kind of stunned, like, wow, I didn't realize this was such a big deal to you. And I think that probably had something to do with how I coped with it or masked it as a dude, and, you know, not showing my emotions. And, you know, the kids still kind of talk about that a little bit. And I've talked to them to some degree, like at an appropriate level, and they'll see me drinking like a ginger ale or something like that. And they'll just say, like my 5-year-old said the other night, he goes, yeah, that's a better drink for you. And I said, yeah, I've decided that, you know, beer and alcohol is not good for me, and I've decided to stop drinking it. So this is what I drink now. And they kind of get it. One of the things my wife told me after the fact that just kind of confirmed my decision was my 5-year-old told her at one point, he said, when he grows up and he becomes a dad, he's going to drink beer every night. He said that while I was drinking. And, you know, man, that like hits home right now, just saying that. It's like, and I didn't even know it. And she's like, I didn't want to tell you, make you feel bad. But she told me after the fact when I quit, and it was really confirmation that they observe everything. And, you know, what you ignore or what you do is just going to become accepted as what you should be doing because you're the role model.
Yeah. And I'm really fascinated that you brought up the idea that I was masking, or you're masking it, and that obviously beer is a very macho, manly thing as described by media. But it was a very emotional thing for you, but you were doing it kind of throughout all your life. Why do you think it was such an emotional moment to say, like, this is my last drink? Was it because the kids were there and you were dedicating it to them? Was it because it was something that you and your gut had been feeling for a long time, like you talked about earlier, a combination of those? Why do you think it was so powerful?
Yeah, it was like I almost needed permission to stop because it was this habitual thing. I think if you would have asked me 3 years ago or 2 years ago or maybe even 1 year ago, I would have been like, oh, I'll never stop drinking. Like, it was just, it's something I look forward to. I enjoyed. I would think about events and go, oh, cool, there's going to be alcohol there. Like, that will, like, I'll enjoy myself more. And I think when this book came into my life, I was very intrigued. In fact, I heard it was on a podcast. It was like a snippet, YouTube snippet. It was a comedian talking to Joe Rogan, and she said, I read this book and I never had a drink since. The title of the YouTube clip was something along the lines of, you know, the book I read and stopped drinking. And I was just so intrigued by that. And I read the book in 3 days. I was like infatuated. Everything it was talking about, I was confirming. And it's similar to a lot of things, but it's just like, you got to be an independent thinker. Like, is this something you enjoy? Is this good for you? Do you enjoy the taste of this? Do you do this because other people do? Do you, you know, it challenged my mindset really hard. And I think that book was just like that epiphany moment where I thought, hey, I can vastly improve my life and have a higher self-esteem of myself and feel better about who I am as a parent, as a leader, as a husband, as a mentor. Like, I can fix something. And I felt empowered. He uses an analogy in the book where he says, imagine you're trapped in a prison for 40 years and there's a combination lock. And one day someone comes by and they give you the lock combination. They give you the sequence and you can just turn that padlock and unlock it and just walk out of that prison cell. And that was such a powerful analogy to me because that book was the combination for me. That book empowered me to go, you're in control of this whole thing. And I think I was emotional because, yeah, I was being a role model, and yeah, it was something I did habitually for 15 years that I decided to cold turkey stop. But just feeling empowered, you know, it's what's next in life that can I accomplish that I'm not doing right now. In fact, you talked about the LinkedIn post. I got a lot of traction off of that, but the biggest post I've had, I talk about drinking a little bit, but I basically say we forget that we write the story of our life. And if there's something we don't like about our life, we can start a new chapter today. And I said something like, be proud of the story that you're writing. And that's the advice I would give my son, my sons or my kids. And so if I would give someone else that advice, why am I not taking that for myself? But that moment when I stopped drinking, I started a new chapter that afternoon, that Sunday afternoon, you know, November 11th, 2019. you know, I started a new chapter that day because it was a chapter I didn't like. And that just feels, that feels really empowering because I had started a new chapter and something else awesome.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. And up in Canada, November 11th is actually Remembrance Day for veterans and military. So
nice.
You know, that's kind of cool. It's an easy date to remember for me.
Yeah, cool.
But kind of going on to that, do you think that a book applies to other potential addictions or other potential daily habits that we use on a day-to-day basis? Like if someone was, you think it would work?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's like, so it started with tobacco and Alan Carr was a smoker for 40 years and a drinker and all this stuff. And he kind of had these epiphany moments about how he looked at tobacco. And his whole thing is you're not using willpower. Like people tell me, I think, so April 11th will be 6 months for me, but like people go, holy shit, dude, it's been 5 months. Like, has that been really hard? And honestly, like, yeah, there's moments where I think about it, but I feel like I'm free. I feel like I'm living a new life. Like, I feel like things have gotten better because I've stopped drinking, not like I'm missing out. And the book talks a lot about willpower. And he's like, willpower is like swimming against the current, or, you know, pushing a boulder up a hill, where, you know, willpower is like you're missing out on something, like, okay, stay strong. And a lot of his principles actually fly in the face of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was an AA member in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I've had a lot of people on LinkedIn that are part of, that have gone through AA, and they're like, stay strong, man, one day at a time. And I'm like, dude, we're playing a different game because I'm kicking ass in life. Like, I don't know what you're holding on to. Like, if you truly feel like you're not missing out on anything, then there's nothing to miss out on.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, it's my tobacco analogy. I've never been a smoker. When people go, I got to step out and have a cigarette, I'm not like dying to join them. I go, all right, like, do your thing. I have no desire to join you. I think that's kind of gross. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the way I'm feeling about alcohol now, is like, I'm witnessing people that get drunk. I'm witnessing people that are, you know, three drinks in, they're saying things that they wouldn't have said sober. And it's almost like, I got like a superhero power that, you know, I'm just of clear mind and just as sharp and, you know, witty and funny. And, you know, so to get back, the book is rooted in a foundational system called the Easy Way. And it started with tobacco, went to alcohol, and he has the Easy Way for gambling. And, you know, you think of any real addiction that people struggle with, he's kind of written, there's been spin-off books, but conceptually it's the same thing. It's reframing what you're actually doing, looking at it through a new light, and then challenging why you would want to do that and taking away the excuses. Like, people say alcohol relaxes them, just fundamentally not true. People say alcohol helps them go to sleep at night. It helps you fall asleep, but you sleep shitty when you drink alcohol. Like, people say I'm better in social settings when I drink alcohol. Like, that's one of the things. This podcast has been pretty serious, but like, I'm a pretty funny guy, or I like to think so, or I don't take myself too seriously. That's what I'll say. You can make the judgment whether I'm funny or not, but I'll make fun of myself. And I told my wife, I'm like, I don't know if I want to stop drinking. So I was talking to her in this 3-day period, like, hey, I'm reading this book, I'm thinking about this, but I was like, I don't know if I'll be funny. And she's like, no, Andrew, she's like, you're funny. You just think you're more funny when you're drinking.
Yeah.
And I thought about that. It's like, it's altering the perception of myself or how I'm perceived, as opposed to how others perceive of me. And so if I can be sharp, you know, if their perception goes down, that's on them. But, you know, me not being in that state has been beneficial for me.
Yeah. To me, it's a lot like when you said you're funnier when you drink. To me, it's a lot like when you're playing drinking games with your friends and you say you're better when you're drunk. And it's like, you're factually, objectively not better, like, psychologically. Right. There's no way you could be better now than you were before.
Exactly.
So I'm like, there is zero chance in that. But I understand your confidence just rises. Like, for me, I feel much more comfortable approaching a girl way out of my league when I got a few drinks in me than when I'm not. But honestly, I could probably have a higher chance of getting her. Like, she might also be drunk at the club too, which is just like, is that really? We both have poor judgment, like, you know, like,
exactly. Right. Well, and they talk about the inhibition piece, and man, I'll tell you, like, it's a big confidence builder because alcohol becomes a crutch. And there was a lot of social settings I had where I was like, I wasn't drinking and I felt anxious about it. But then like my wife and I throw a big Halloween party. It's the only cool thing we do all year. We had, you know, 75 people at our house, and, you know, and it's a big drinking event. And it was so weird this year because I quit drinking. Oh, I said November 11th. It was October 11th. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
So it was mid October. And so I bought like hundreds of dollars of alcohol and I didn't drink any of it, which was a weird thing too.
Yeah.
It kind of, it gives a different perception on everything, but I was so nervous about it. And like, I wasn't really public about it at that point and no one asked me anything. I was just holding the red cup like everyone else. And everyone thought I was funny and interesting and I was dancing and people thought it was like hilarious and cool. And I'm like, they don't know, you know? So it was empowering to me. At the night was over, I was like, hey, I didn't drink and I had a great time and people still thought I was fun and funny and interesting. And so that was a big confidence builder for me. But to feel like I don't need anything in a social setting to be funny. I don't need anything to go approach someone and have a conversation. And I don't have social anxiety. I'm very extroverted, but like, just knowing that I don't need that thing is actually, it's a confidence builder as well.
Yeah. Well, it kind of touches back to what you were talking about when it came to, you're not interested in smoking at all, but for people that may feel like they have social anxiety or feel like they get left out easily, that becomes a way to socialize or part of your social credit. You know, it's the same with having more followers on Instagram than other people. It's a way of like creating a hierarchy in society or in a social setting. And so that's why I was in a past job when I was working retail, I would go out for drinks with people. And then if there's six of us at a table, five of them are smokers, all five would go have a cigarette at the same time. So I'd be just left at the table by myself. Like a weird moment like that, right? I have no desire to smoke, but I have a desire to be with people.
Right.
And it's the same with happy hour. Happy hour does the same thing where it's like
exactly
4:30, drinks are cheaper, come out with your friends. But if you're not going there to drink, people will be like, oh, or, you know, you have no desire to do that, but you desire to be in a social setting.
Yeah.
And then that's when you kind of need to be like, you know, do I be made fun of for not getting drinks? Are these people socially accepting of me? Like, are they going to make fun of me? And then you just have all these questions.
Right.
So you kind of just like cater to what your thoughts would be. And then you buy a drink because that's the easiest way to avoid questions. To me, it's the same thing with non-alcoholic beer and carrying around a red solo cup. If you have a red solo cup at a party, no one's going to ask you really if you're drinking or not. It could be water and you just like maybe lie and say it's vodka. But I've always found it fascinating to me as well as like zero alcoholic beer. I'm like, who would drink that just because I like the taste of beer that much? That doesn't even cross my mind because I hate the taste of beer normally. So I'm like, why would anyone get 0%? But even that at a party, it's like now you feel like you're still drinking beer and you can say you're drinking beer, but it's, you can kind of get away with the whole it's non-alcoholic kind of vibe and you're not really catering to the social expectations that, you know, you're drinking. So I always think that the social aspect is a huge part of it too.
Yeah. And it's just being secure enough with yourself. I mean, I've never gone down the non-alcoholic route because, and this one thing I learned in the book, it's training your brain that you're missing out on something. Like, oh, you have the version of this, the unleaded version. And to me, it's like more, you know, it's more about going, I'm not missing anything. I think in the social setting, it's been easier as I've been more public, but I just kind of own in the fact that I'm not going to make anyone feel judged or I don't want to weird anyone out. But at the same time, I'm not apologizing for not drinking. And if someone's got a problem with that, like, I feel pretty confident in who I am. And, you know, I've definitely missed out on things. I'm probably not getting invited as much stuff, but shit, man, I'm 35 year old dad. Like I know who I am at this point. I'm not trying to impress anyone, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And obviously that kind of knowing yourself is a huge journey. So kind of what would your advice be to not, this isn't like alcohol related at all, but to people that kind of have that one thing that they want to get rid of in their life that maybe they feel like it's holding them back on a mental level, kind of what would your one piece of advice be to them to stop what they're doing or to really take control of that aspect of their life?
That's where I hope. And that's why I went public with it. It's once again, it's not an anti-alcohol thing, but if there's something you don't like about yourself, like you're empowered to fix it. I think the question that you need to ask yourself, and no one should influence this, it should just be your own thoughts, is how is this one thing serving you? You know, if I go to the casino every Friday and I blow $200, or, you know, if I smoke cigarettes or if I drink alcohol or there's, you know, other substance or whatever, there's a lot of things that could be bad vices. You need to ask how this is serving you. How is this making you better? And, you know, alcohol was one of those things where it didn't get me any closer to my goals. Every night became a little foggy. I started posting content on LinkedIn 1 or 2 weeks after I stopped drinking, but I had this void to fill. And I've been very active on that platform specifically because it kind of caters to what I want to do is, you know, more speaking, more sales kind of stuff, and more kind of personal development, I would say, than any other social platform. But what I realize now, looking back 5 months dry, is that gap has been filled with really productive times, and it's got me closer to the goals that I want to achieve. So I think whatever it is, the first question you need to ask yourself is, how is this serving me or how is it not serving me? Because that kind of gets to the root of the why you're really going to quit. Because, you know, if my wife just said, I really want you to quit drinking, that might last for a few days or a week. But I knew, like, in my soul, and it was so important to me, for my kids, for myself, for my health, all these reasons to stop. And that's why it's had lasting, you know, sticking power for me.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question in terms of how is this serving me? I think sometimes when we think about these addictions or these holes that we fill with certain substances or moments, we always think kind of short term, and where it's very much like self-satisfaction, whether it's, you know, drug addiction or alcohol or even like video games. There's a lot of things that people use to fill a void in their life. And that's why, to me, whenever anyone says something that is not addictive, I say anything can be addictive if it's filling some insecurity or some hole in your life that you're not confronting head on.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what it is, because, you know, some people have addiction to alcohol when others don't. Some people have addiction to video games when others don't. Some people, I would say, are addicted to marijuana when others don't. Some people have addiction to pornography or other, right, like food or sugar.
Right.
Yep. And there's these different things that all cater to that. And I'm like, anything can be addictive if you're not just paying attention. So like, how would this serve me if I stopped doing it? Would I be able to put more time into this? Your mental health, I'm sure, would go up. Because even for myself, it's like if there are things that I am addicted to, I spend so much time and energy thinking about those things.
Yes.
That I could be focusing that energy somewhere else but you could just remove it from your life.
Right. Yeah. Emotional energy, just mental capacity. And then in the moment, you know, alcohol is one of those things where it's like, you know, we're all big Green Bay Packer fans here in Wisconsin. And when they play at noon on Sunday, I was the guy that was drinking at 11 a.m. like, all right, let's get the party started. And if that goes till 8 p.m., you know, you just spend a lot of time in that hobby, and it definitely like precludes you from getting other productive things done that maybe get you closer to your goals.
Mm-hmm. And then in regards to something that we haven't really touched on was, you know, the reasoning why you wanted to be a very involved father, which was that your parents, you grew up in a divorced household. Can you kind of go into that as well, and like how you think you've really come full circle in that aspect as a father, how you've grown as a man in those moments, and you know, obviously drinking alcohol and now quitting alcohol is part of that journey as well. But I'd like you to kind of go into that as well, like full circle it.
Yeah, I mean, I have an awesome dad and I have an awesome stepdad, and my 8-year-old is in second grade, and that was the time in my life when my parents said they were getting divorced. So, you know, I was old enough to kind of know what's going on, but I think about that a lot to go. And I love my parents and I have a great relationship with both of them, but it's like, I do feel pride in like when he turns 9 or goes into third grade, like he's kind of gone further with his parents together than I had as a personal experience. You know, my parents had a pretty like civil divorce. You know, I mean, there was some argument here and there, but I wouldn't call it nasty. And they stayed in relatively close proximity. But, you know, I saw my dad, I think, 2 nights a week. I think that was the deal back then. This is like the early 90s. I think it's more like 50-50 now. But nonetheless, even though my dad was great, I just had very limited time with him, you know. And my mom was a single mom for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And she was working. And, you know, I had 2 older brothers, and they helped a lot. Like, there's a lot of times when I came home from school and they were the, you know, the only ones there because my mom was working. And so, you know, I just think about all those opportunities that I'll, you know, being in a healthy marriage and being able to be as present as possible and teach him as much as I can and lead by example as much as I can. Like, I'm just embracing those moments. And in some weird way, like the adversity of my parents being divorced probably helped me grow a lot. And I probably learned a lot from that. But at the same time, it's like, I think it's just natural to want, you know, for your children as good or better of a situation than you had. So, you know, there was pros that came out of that. I have like an awesome stepdad and step siblings that came around at one point. And, you know, I still have relationships with those people. I actually saw my stepdad today, and I had a conversation with my real father today. Ironically enough, not for any particular reason than just they're still a part of my life. So, yeah, just trying to do the best with the situation that I have. And having a really solid foundation. I've been with my wife for 20 years. We dated in high school and we've been married going on 12 years now. So, you know, just having a really solid relationship, and we still enjoy time together when the kids aren't around, you know, like all those kind of things are really cool. So just trying to create the best environment for my children.
Yeah. And kind of to wrap up that thought is, how important is it to you as a, you know, beyond just the alcohol, showing your two sons and your, and you have a daughter too, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Your two sons and your daughter.
Yep.
How important is it to you to show them what kind of, what it is to be a man and what it is to be a partner? Because obviously together for 20 years, you said, is a very long time.
Yes.
So, you know, I've been reading a book called Man Up. I forget who the author is right now, but it's like man up in your parenting, man up in your marriage, man up in your job. But like, how important is it to you to really be that model as a man for your sons and a partner or a loving husband for your daughter?
Yeah, the daughter's a whole different piece. And obviously she's so young, but I definitely am more sensitive to that. I think for my boys, they'll see me take my wife out on a date and grandma will come over and watch him. And I will make a point to say, I'm taking your mother out on a date. We're going to spend some time together. And even though, you know, we got all you crazy kids and we love being with you, it's important for us to have, you know, one-on-one time, and someday you'll be married and you should do the same, you know, that kind of a thing. That's a little direct, but I think it's worth making a point of it. You know, as far as being a man, like, they know I go to work. They understand that, like, money, you know, kind of the traditional breadwinner kind of piece. My wife does a really good job of, like, acknowledging, like, if we say prayers as a family or we're doing, like, moments of gratitude, like, before we eat dinner or something, she'll say, thank you for daddy, you know, kind of to the kids. Thank you for daddy for working hard so that we can have this excellent house and eat this food. And like, I appreciate her saying that, you know, it's easier for her to put that on a pedestal than myself, obviously, because, you know, it just sounds like you're bragging or trying to prove a point. And, you know, just things like, I don't know, they see me run, I'm a runner. I was supposed to run a half marathon in April that got canceled, but like, it's important for me, not because I want them to think I'm awesome, but like, I want them to see me training and, okay, dad's going out for runs. Sometimes I push him in the stroller, but they know it's significant because my wife will go drop me off 8 miles from our house and then I'll run home, kind of a thing. Like, they get some vibe for what it is. And to me, that's not about the athletic portion. It's just about having a goal and willing to work hard for it. I think that's really important. And, you know, that goes for money and, you know, fitness and anything in life. So the money thing's tricky. That's hard for them to understand, but the running component, it's pretty tangible. And like, they came to a race and they saw me run a half marathon. And I mean, they didn't see exactly how long it is, but they knew it was a pretty damn long time. So that was cool. Like, I think that's important to me, not because I want them to think I'm an awesome athlete, but I want them to see me being passionate about something. And my goal is to run a full marathon in the fall. And I'd love for them to witness that as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's beautiful. And I think that's something I really want to ask the fathers that I have on this, my podcast now, because, you know, I've never even dated anyone, for context, but, you know, I'm always looking for people outside of my, like, I've watched my parents, they've been together for 33 years, but I'm always trying to look for people outside of them for advice as well. You know, as I grow as a man and as I grow in an individual, I think there's no such thing as too much fatherly advice in a lot of ways. It's like, I think it always comes back for the better. But really, kind of to wrap up this episode, I want to end off with the three questions I always ask my guests. So the first one is, what is one piece of advice that your father or an important male figure in your life gave you that you live by every day?
So one of the things my dad has said to me that he said his father and I think his grandfather told him is, never wish your life away. It's kind of like a no regret kind of a thing, but you know, the alcohol piece is definitely intertwined with that. It's like, if I fast forward my life to 30 years from now, do I wish I drank more or less alcohol as an example? Or, you know, like the LinkedIn post, it's like 20 years from now, would I have been like, oh shoot, I should have done that, right? When I was hesitant to click on the mouse. So, you know, never wish your life away is kind of like, go embrace it. The worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to fail, you know? And I think my father's even admitted some things to me at age 70, like, he's seen me run And he said to me, you know, I still have thoughts about I should have ran a marathon at some point. And I think that's really interesting. It's almost, it's not a horrible regret. You know, it's not the worst thing in the world, but it feels a little unsatisfying to him that he, it's something he didn't do. And that gives me a lot of like juice to go, all right, we got to go do all this now. Like, let's do it now. There's no better time than now. Go start the chapter today.
Yeah, beautiful. And then what is one piece of advice that you wish your father or an important male figure gave you?
I think one of the things, it's something I admire about my dad, but it's something that I kind of push against the grain, is I kind of wish there was a little more like, be an individual. Don't be concerned about what other people think. Be a free thinker. You know, my dad's a very, he's like conservative German, you know, descent. And it's, his parents grew up in the Great Depression, which is really cool. And I admire the hell out of that. But they were a little more like fall in line, like one in the hands, two in the bush, like don't take a risk kind of a thing. Like I asked my dad, he did taxes for 35 years. And I asked him at the end of his career, why'd you decide to get into like being an accountant and doing taxes? And he literally said, I just thought it was a good way to make money. You know, whereas I want my kids to go, yeah, making money is a part of it, but I want them to go, I'm really passionate about this. Like I love, like in my day job, I love working with people and I love developing young talent. I've hired a bunch of kids out of college, kids, you know, college students that have grown their career and progressed. And I love that. Like, I don't take credit for it, but I admire them and I'm proud of them and I feel like a mentor in their life. So I would say that to sum it up, kind of like just be yourself, be an individual, think for yourself, go chase whatever gets you excited.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I find really fascinating about my generation as well, is that that seems to be the language that a lot of people use, is, you know, your parents kind of grew up, they thought about how can we make the most money or money that that kind of pays the bills and whatnot. And then we kind of live in a very fortunate society and generation where it's much more, you know, pursue your happiness. There's so many different options that we have now that our parents didn't have. It's like this little, I don't know if you want to call it privilege, but this idea that, you know, just society has changed and there's just the internet has obviously created a lot of opportunity for people to pursue things and come up with all these new ideas, YouTube, Instagram, like there's just so many different caveats of being you that I really think that that's a really interesting like way that society has shifted. And then kind of to close it out, what is one piece of advice that you'd want to pass down to future generations or your kids?
Yeah, it's easy for me because I got three kids. It's been well documented here. I think a lot about the quote. I think it's credited to Jim Rohn, but I've had it written on my whiteboard for like 7 years where it says, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. And I think my advice, if I'd wrap that up, is choose the people around you wisely. And that could mean who you pick as a partner in life. That could mean where you go to work every day. That could mean where you spend your free time. I think people influence us more than we think. I know, like for myself, having awesome friends, having an awesome wife, going to an awesome place at work, like that's just been everything for me because that's definitely molded who I am. And I think, you know, there can be toxic relationships that people hang on to for a bunch of different reasons that aren't serving them. Just like a bad habit, like we've talked about bad vices, like, is this serving you? Is this relationship serving you? So I would say choose who you spend your time with and who you're around wisely.
Perfect. Beautiful. And then finally, Andrew, to close it off, I want to have you share what you got going on in your life.
Yeah, I mean, I have a day job that's very demanding that I love as a sales manager, but I've been fairly active, as I talked about on LinkedIn. That's where I post most of my content. It's usually business related, but sometimes has an entertaining or humorous component, I hope. That's where I do most of it. I have a running page I talked about running called Dad's Got the Runs on Instagram. It's a satire page. It's basically a dad giving poor running advice, but it's just my weird twisted way of humor. And then I have a website, andrewmetz.net, where I'm open to kind of linking out content, but open to speaking engagements, potentially coaching opportunities, other podcasts, anywhere that I can help people. That's really it. Like I said, I have a day job. I'm not like a freelance guy looking for any opportunity, but you know, where I can be impactful or the time's well served, I'm willing to do it. And just like this podcast here, it seemed like a totally worthy opportunity. So I really appreciate the opportunity, Luke.
Yeah, no worries. I'm very appreciative of you sharing your story. It's an angle that I hadn't gone on the podcast yet, talking about alcohol this like in depth. So I'm very, very happy that you came on and shared your story. I think that's a true sign of exactly what you're trying to do with your story. You're not just trying to sit on it. I know you said you're not evangelical against alcohol, but you're evangelical about how it has affected your life and, you know, made you the person that you are today, which I very much value you coming on in here and sharing, because I think if there's a lot of men listening to this, they'll probably relate to the idea of, you know, drinking alcohol because it's cool, or they think it's cool when maybe it's not their favorite thing to do. So I think, I thank you very much for coming on, sharing that part of your story. And I look forward to having my guests hear it. My audience here, not my guests. You're my guest.
Well, I'll listen to it too, but I appreciate it, Luke. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode with Andrew Metz. I really, really love this conversation, talking about how addiction can have a shape on our lives. You know, one quote that really stuck out to me was, "Never wish your life away," but also the thought of, how is this one thing serving you? I think that's a thought that we can all take a lot from in regards to the things that we find can take over our lives, even if it's something as simple or not so simple as alcohol, depending on your kind of relationship and the things in your life. You know, you can find Andrew again, as he said, on LinkedIn at Andrew Metz, Metz spelled M-E-T-Z. That's where I found him. That's where he's active a lot of the time. And then he also has a running page open to the public on Instagram called at Dad's Got the Runs. It's much more of a funny angle and approach, less serious, so you can follow him there. And he's also in the process of building out his website, andrewmetz.net. You know, it was great to have him on the show. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review on iTunes or message me on IG at The Imperfect Pod, or you can connect with myself on LinkedIn at Luke West. I'd love to hear what you have to say and what you learned, and let's build a world of intentional and purposeful conversations. And thank you to the boy, Matt McClelland, again, for all his hard work editing the podcast. I'll talk to you all soon.